It's Monday, June 26th, 2006, and you're listening to Episode 7 of Hear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 and a half minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and people have accused me of having some preference in the order I list the hosts. And that's
I think John was wrong. It is in the order of manliness. No, because he said it was in reverse order of manliness. Right. I think it's in order of manliness.
You're both wrong. It's actually just I go counterclockwise, starting at the person directly in front of me, which is you.
So. Which is the most manly person here.
And your name is
Chad.
Right. So Chad is the other host with me today. We also have Adam.
But they're unimportant.
If by manly you just mean hairy, then yes, you are always first.
What can I say, ladies?
He comes out of the shower every morning LARPing a Sasquatch.
You know, I could say that's not true and deny it, but do I do get out of the shower and go...
You make these cute little bird noises. And we also have with us today Aram.
Hi.
And for those of you that aren't our forum...
Axe.
Yeah, for those of you that are on a forum, his name is not Axe. I'm not clear how that came up. Axe is a really cool name. If someone had named him Axe, I would be like, that's a nice name. Yeah. But his name is not Axe. It's Aram.
Aram.
Do you prefer Aram or Aram?
Aram.
Aram.
And it helps if you roll the R.
But I don't care.
I can't roll R's.
No, me either.
Okay.
So, Axe.
Okay, so Axe.
What are some of the worst names that people have butchered your name as?
Abraham.
Abraham.
Enron.
Amen.
Amen. Yesterday I got armoire.
That's awesome. Except it's a piece of furniture.
And it's so damn comfy.
Yeah. It is.
You're so functional.
Now, Aram, or Arm, or Enron, or armoire, or Axe, or whatever his name may be
today. You used to work in a call center.
I did.
And you changed your name.
Dave.
Dave, yeah, that's right.
Aram is a relatively new gamer. You've gamed for, three games of one campaign?
Correct.
Noob.
Boonlar.
And what was the game?
D&D.
Okay, and how did that go?
Very badly.
All right, now this is a smut show, so be specific. We want names and details and all the horror. What happened?
Well, the DM had trouble keeping focus, as did the characters. And maybe it's because the story itself was just so effing stale. But
not that you're bitter or anything.
No. But we would camp for an evening after a long, long, long battle, and the characters would say something to the effect of, well, I'm going to go over to so-and-so's tent, and we're going to, you know, bow, chicka, wow, wow.
Wow.
And
do the nasty.
The DM would say something like, well, you can't just say that. I mean, we got to know how it went. I mean, did you have an orgasm? And the player would be
this
like,
sounds like a large room of fat, ugly people.
That's why I left. And she'd say, well, you better roll for it, you know.
Did she have an orgasm chart?
No, but it was...
I'm surprised.
It was a percentile die.
That was clearly one of the DM discretion charts.
Wow.
Of course, to me, I think that you could flip a coin.
I don't think...
It's based on your charisma, dude.
I have seen some really banal, immature, profane content.
Yeah, from us.
No, this, well, from
in our current
people,
game.
People we've known more than from the people sitting here. I won't name names, but we've had some pretty bad offenders. But I can't say I've ever specifically seen that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I don't think I've ever really dealt with the act of sex in a game, per se. It's just something we've never, all the different groups I've had, never really wanted to get into. Nobody cared. Yeah, certainly never rolled for orgasm.
That's the dark side of gaming.
Apparently, it is. And you know what? I'm not so naive to think that yours is a unique case that it never happens. I know that there's lots of people out there who bust out the rule books for the sex, but I just don't get it.
I don't either.
If I want to go have sex, I'll go have sex.
Well, yeah, it seems inappropriate to the game, out of place, detracting. It's one of the things, you know, I can typically see things from other people's perspectives, that this doesn't work for me, but I understand why it works for you. But this is one of those things where,
mm-hmm.
I just don't get it. I don't understand how...
Well, I don't know. A lot of those like Vampire the Masquerade games are sexual in nature.
And
well,
you have to admit that role-playing can be an inherent part of a person's sexuality. Not mine, per se. But there are a lot of people who really get into that.
Are you talking about role-playing in the bedroom?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's LARPing.
It stands to reason, you know, that sexuality would, for some people, infect role-playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it actually rolls right into one of the topics I had written down here for us to discuss today.
Sex and gaming?
No.
Oh.
No.
Then next week?
No. Sex and gaming. We do want to talk about sex and relationships and gaming, but that was not the topic for this podcast. But rather, I had written down here that we as role players, we tend to take this obsession of ours and put it where it doesn't belong. Or I guess I should say where it doesn't belong so much as where you wouldn't intuitively think it should go. And around Axe, Armoire, talking about it in the bedroom kind of made me think of that. Mm-hmm. For example, many years ago when the first Doom game first came out, I was in high school at the time and we played it a lot. And I remember we'd walk down the halls of the high school and if I saw two pipes on an empty wall about 6 feet apart, I knew there was a secret door right there.
Yeah, we called it Doomovision. I mean, did you guys ever get anything like that?
Oh, yeah. I played too much Mario Kart one time, and I actually swerved away from a yellow plastic bag thinking it was a bunch of bananas.
Bunch of bananas.
And you hit a little old lady, and then you had to go to
jail. They
would
have caused my car to completely spin out.
You would have lost a balloon.
They would have.
But, for example, taking this back to role-playing games, I find myself wanting to put story and plot and characters where there isn't any.
Right.
The original XCOM game, when I found out there was a character editor for it, I went in, wiped out my whole team, replaced it with people I knew, people I used to know, a few of my favorite fictional characters, and when we went on a mission, they behaved according to character. Mm-hmm. That if there was someone I knew who tended to be really protective, that they would stand back and guard the landing craft, while some more aggressive people do this or that. Or if I knew so-and-so was really protective of this other person, they wouldn't go very far from them. And then, of course, you had the plot line after you get back to base of trying to figure out, man, how are they going to respond to the fact that this person who's really important to these three people just died?
Yeah.
And on the next mission, they're not even going to be there because they're so ripped up over that. I guess you also get the ubiquitous thing in most gaming groups that there isn't a gaming group around that hasn't used a die inappropriately as a decision maker.
Right.
Or if you got three
burritos. What movie are we going to go see? What are we going to have to eat? Who gets to use the microwave for the burrito?
If you got three burritos and one microwave, you roll initiative to see who gets to nuke it. Yeah, I've wondered why is it that, I don't know, I guess it's just a human nature. You do anything too much. Or even just a lot, maybe too much is too harsh of a phrase, but you do anything a lot, it starts to bleed over into other areas of your life. I mean, everyone here has had something they've been working really hard on, then they start dreaming about it, or they start relating everything they see to it. But it seems like with role players, we do it almost intentionally.
Yeah.
That we start to use that, and this is, I don't mean some delusional thing, like we can't distinguish between fantasy
like,
and reality.
But just like a role-playing game that you play, you know, you have three characters and they're going through the plot, and they don't really develop the characters for them. Well, you know, you're a role player. That's what you do. That's your hobby. So you start coming up. Yeah. And then it's like they can make multiple, if it's not a too linear of a game, they can make multiple decisions. Well, as a role player, do you sit there and you make the best decision you can for the video game to advance your characters? Or do you play it in character?
Yeah. or the character's motivation.
Yeah.
Or you make it a comedic tongue-in-cheek thing with the rules in real life. Now, one example this we had recently that was a bad idea and we're never doing again, don't ever make a party game out of creating character sheets for you and your friends, ever. All right. When we first got into this podcasting thing, one of the things I was most concerned about was I didn't know what the community as a whole was going to be like. You get into some businesses, the competition's very cutthroat. They're doing all kinds of crooked things to damage each other so they can be on top. And when I got into this, the main thing that I was hoping for with the other competing shows was that we just all kind of peacefully coexist and honorably do our own thing. But the more we get into this, the more I have been absolutely blown away by how cool the other podcasters are. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you how many supportive emails, how many supportive audios we have gotten from the hosts of other shows just writing in to say, hey, we like what you guys are doing, you know, keep up the good fight. And so I want to take a quick second here just to thank a few of these folks by names for what you guys have been doing to support our show. I mean, really completely unsolicited. And we deeply appreciate that. So I want to thank Harping Mick. and you can find his site at harpingmonkey.com. I want to thank Chuck and Lonnie from the Dragon's Landing Inn, and I also want to thank JJ, who goes by The Working Man, for Fistful of Comics. And those shows in particular, you guys have been awesome. I want to thank you guys a lot. There's been other shows that have supported us in passing, but those are the big ones. The other bit of business we got to cover here real quick before we dig into some other topics is we had a contest started in our last podcast regarding where the name Fear the Boot came from. And we told people if they would come up with their own version of where Fear the Boot came from, we would pick a winner. And that winner would get a custom forum title on our forums. And we're going to tell you in this podcast where the name really came from. So the winner of this is Renaissance Wolf, and I'm going to read his story real quick. So Renaissance Wolf, if you want to send me a custom forum title, as long as it fits our forum rules, it can be anything you want. So
congratulations.
So his story goes as follows. This all started a few years ago. We were out together, maybe drinking, maybe not, when once again the beloved and much maligned Monostat gaming system was brought up. I don't know who's maligned. Who has ever maligned Monostat?
Fools.
Monostat is beauty in motion.
Well, you know, it is a very vicious, vicious game.
It can.
Well, past level 15 it is.
You're thinking classic Monostat.
Depends on the edition.
I'm not thinking the new revisions.
I only think classic Monostat. It's the only game.
No. John's not here to defend himself, so we'll save that fight for later. Continuing the story. Finally giving in to peer pressure, we decided to make a campaign to go with the rules. Bad idea. There were many discussions and lots of yelling, but in the end, this is what we had. A cyberpunk fantasy world in which not only had the standard fantasy races come back, but some additional ones as well. Most notably among them, the Smurfs. Now, our illustrious storyteller at the time decided that Gargamel was too stale of an NPC to use as the archenemy, so he created a new one, a human toddler named Micah, who one day came across the enclave of the Smurfs. Of course, he had his cute little toddler hiking boots on and started a rampage of stomping and smashing. From that day forward, all the Smurfs were terrified of the boot, and a new evil was born. Fear of the boot was whispered to children who were naughty, and to girl Smurfs in the back seat of little Smurf Chevys. We all fear the boot, and you don't want to die a ... do you? Eventually, this became the campaign name, as the characters decided that without the boot, the toddler was harmless. But that adventure, my friends, is another story for another time. So there's your winning story of where Fear the Boot came from.
And we're adopting it as the actual real story, too.
That was a story with lasting comedic value.
Yes, yeah, unlike really the real
to,
story.
Do we really have to tell that real story? Can we just post it?
We will, but we'll come back to that in a minute. We'll build the suspense a little longer.
Suspense.
I want to talk about senseless charts and role-playing books.
Come on. What are you talking about? Those don't exist.
I am completely in favor of significant useful charts and role-playing books. For example, in Battletech, they have some charts for doing quick compositions of enemy units.
Right.
There are things like the treasure tables in D&D, mm-hmm. which, if you don't have any specific loot in mind, is a nice way to keep things on target. But Adam was flipping through...
Should we even name it?
Riffs.
Yeah, well,
I guess we will.
We will name it.
I've already done it.
It's been named. And Adam, what is this quality chart
Adam
you came across?
Adam at feartheboot.com.
It's not charts. It's a whole series of pages on how to create a specific character. A crazy. And let's see, there's the random crazy element table, and then on the next page,
because
the random power food table. One to five is garlic.
So, what is a power food? You have to excuse me here. I mean, if we're not talking about like a carb bomb, what is a power food? Do we even know?
Why does the character believe these foods give him or her incredible powers? I think, it's the Popeye syndrome.
So it's like Popeye.
That's awesome.
These are all sorts of, like, crazy character traits.
So you make a crazy guy, and you're not creative enough to actually come up with something crazy about him, so you roll on this chart, he's like Popeye.
Yeah.
And he gets his power from bananas. I can't even go on with this. I can't even think of a joke better than the joke itself.
It's just so out there.
Let's
see, there's a whole power word section.
Oh, God.
Multiple personalities. Step one, how many separate personalities?
Roll 2d6.
Step two, who is the dominant personality?
Roll 1d4.
Step three, who are the other personalities?
See chart 5A.
And then there are two full pages of separate personality types.
Yeah, I've always loved the in Palladium games in general, the insanity table. That if your character goes under some great duress, you're supposed to roll on the sanity table. So it's like, okay, the Invid just came down and mauled your family and dismembered you and you barely survived, and roll on that chart, you're now afraid of boats.
Yes.
It's like, what?
Excellent.
Excellent.
Well, that may not work in role-playing, but do you remember Eternal Darkness?
No.
No.
I do.
Yeah.
Wait, the video game?
The video game.
Oh. They had all sorts of cool sanity
effects.
I was
thinking it was a role-playing game, and I'm like...
When you started to lose sanity, they would do cool things. Like,
yeah.
At one point, the game does a Windows blue screen of death.
Yeah,
and you're like,
your game crashes.
Dude, what the hell? The game crashed, and then it pops back to the game, and you're like, oh,
yeah.
That's awesome.
Like, you'll be walking along, and suddenly the picture you're looking at slowly, very slowly starts to tilt to the left. And it's so slow, you don't even notice it until it's, like, really well tilted, and you're like, what the? You're walking through a library, and then if your insanity is really high, like, a book will fly from one shelf to the other, like in Ghostbusters. Walls will start to bleed. It's really cool
it
stuff.
It looks like the system restarts. It'll go back, like, to the Nintendo logo.
Oh, yeah, and it's
logo.
Crazy stuff, too.
Yeah.
You'll hit the first plot point, like, the first major plot point where everything is sort of revealed. And if your insanity's high, it will stop, say, game over, thanks for playing, buy Eternal Darkness 2. It'll be an ad, and then it'll go back to the game.
Wow.
And the character will be screaming, too. It'll be so funny.
Best insanity effects of any game out there.
Oh, the best one is, you know how when you turn off a television, you press the power off button, and it turns black, and there's that sort of white line that goes into the middle, and it kind of blips?
Right.
It does that. You'll be in the middle of playing, fighting an enemy, all of a sudden, it doesn't actually turn off your TV. It blanks the screen, and it simulates that white line and pop. And you're like, what just happened? And then it comes back on.
This sounds like, on a conceptual level, it's really cool, but in practice, it'd be really annoying.
No, it's cool. It's really, really neat. Wow. Because it basically simulates your character going insane.
But getting back to this topic, I've never understood these charts where you have really a common sense consequence and a character action. Like, your family's mauled by Invid, so you think now you hate Invid.
But no, you hate boats.
Right, but you have this chart that you would just interject in there for no particular reason, just to give you something to roll
against.
Well,
these are the lack of creativity charts. It's the game designers assume that the mass public who is playing their game has no creativity, cannot come up with a character who has multiple personalities and is so non-creative that they think that they have to provide charts for people to come up with personality traits.
Yeah.
Now, on one hand, I think this is a good idea for a GM. Like, if you run into a guy and you just want, he's nuts, but you don't want to sit there and come up with 20 pages of psychosis and charts and whatnot. You just spend 2 minutes, like, hold on a second, guys, roll out. Okay, he's this, this, and this, and this is how he's crazy.
Right.
Even then, I wouldn't do that.
Well,
but.
You know, and I've got some mileage out of, in the third edition DM's guide for D&D, there's a quirks chart for NPC quirks. And it's a great way, you roll on that once or twice, just they ran into a barkeeper, you need to do something with them. It makes them memorable.
Yeah.
Just to pound out some sort of quirk on NPCs that are going to be tossed at anyway.
Like, for example, conversely, I can remember, I want to say this is in the Invid Invasion game, for an Invid here, that when you show up to a town, you can actually roll the population of the town, even down to the plot points that will occur while you're in the town. It's like, what is the role of a GM anymore? I mean,
you can run your entire game by rules.
You're just like, hey, what's going to happen in today's game? Oh, I have no idea. Let me grab a chart and find out.
Yeah.
Isn't the point of this some kind of creativity and self-initiative? And once again, I don't have a problem using charts to round things
as
out.
As you always say, you know, shade of gray.
Right, all things shade of gray. But come on, I mean, when it dominates your game, you have just gone simply too far.
So is Palladium the new Rifts?
Or
the new Shadowrun?
You know what? This is like the third try we've had at this. And we were doing so good in not mentioning Shadowrun. And then
at
you.
It was looming. It was looming on the horizon.
Jerk.
It was looming on the horizon.
Like,
you're off
diarrhea.
The show. We brought you off the island.
It's like this diarrhea of your mind you can only hold for so long. And then it's got to blow.
This is like this Tourette's-like explosion of Shadowrun! Shadowrun! I can't stand
you out in public
it.
Again.
All right, well,
cyberpunk, pure.
Put away your croissant.
All right, we're gonna settle Chad. We're gonna settle Chad down here a bit, and then we're actually gonna spring right back to Palladium. Before we dig into today's advice topic, which, by the way, is dealing with players that won't stay on the plot.
Well, to completely throw you off the topic
about
in relation
with hosts
to
who won't stay on the topic.
Yeah, throw us off the table. What is your opinion on Palladium games?
Well, that's like what I want to come back to.
Oh, And no, you're not. You're lying. You're teasing me.
Oh, no, no. I'm not lying.
You're teasing me.
I don't lie. I do tease, but I don't lie.
Well, that's kind of spooky.
Remind me not to take you out on a date.
Now, to calm Chad down, right. Here we go. Calm Chad down.
Yes.
The real story of where Fear the Boot came from.
Oh, boy. Tranquilizing
effects. We'll calm everybody down.
Yeah. All right. Just in brief. Many years ago, our group, our gaming group, like most gaming groups, has morphed over the years. We've lost people, gained people. Mm. But many years ago, I've known Chad since literally I was 3 years old. I've known him longer, yep. And some of my family members have been alive. And he and I, we used to hang out with the gaming group that gamed in one guy's basement. And Chad purchased a pair of
combat boots.
And I don't mean like jack boots. I don't mean like...
like something you get at Hot Topics with the flames and the big heels. And this was kind of like, this was years ago, and it was before the whole like big boot thing came popular, I guess. Not to say that I'm some crazy trendsetter. It was more like... I was into military type stuff, so I went to a military surplus store and I bought like these SWAT team combat, the high techs they're called.
Right, yeah, and they go up maybe about a third to a half of your shin, yeah. And they're more, they almost look like, I guess, kind of like black hiking boots almost, but I'm sure people know what we're talking about.
Right, right.
So
if you're really curious, yeah, look on the web.
He got a pair of those, and he was just so pleased with them that they became a predominant icon in his mind, and
yes.
The boots got mentioned quite a bit.
And then they stomp things.
Yeah, they stomped
lots of things.
Like if you had a bad character sheet, you'd end up with a boot print on it mm-hmm. when you got up to go get a drink or something. And when that pair of boots got so beat up you couldn't wear them anymore, they were retired for new boots, and those boots were hung from the ceiling just as a sign of power yeah. and a warning to anyone who would...
kind of like a horseshoe over your door frame or something. It's yeah. Just sort of to ward off...
Evil spirits.
Anything that got stomped.
Right, exactly. So just because of the fact this had just become sort of an inside joke, we did a few things with it. We talked about starting a creative arts company called Das Boot Productions, mm-hmm. but...
You can't do that.
You can't do that because it's
copyright.
Yeah,
it's a movie.
It's a funny
well,
pun.
You could do that.
Well, yeah, you could
you
do
could
it.
Do that. Just
you could
last,
do a lot of things.
Wouldn't last real long. So when we went to make the podcast, I was trying to think back to icons that have been in this group for a while because I didn't want to pick just a generic name. Mm-hmm. I wanted to pick something that was easy to remember.
Do you remember any of the icons that you thought and rejected?
I honestly toyed with like RPG Dog and a couple. I don't remember. Yeah. But it's like
I'm
none,
glad you didn't decide.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, honestly, none of them were that good. But I wanted something that wasn't just good, but something that was significant to this group.
Right.
Something that was memorable to the listeners.
Something that rolled off the tongue.
And something yeah. that was so unique, the web address would be free.
Yeah, that was the important one right there.
Because I couldn't just go get boot.com. I mean, that's probably been taken for 10 years now. Mm-hmm. So we just playing around with words came up with Fear the Boot, and that's where the name actually came from. Mm-hmm. So, but from now on, this is the only place you'll hear that answer. If anyone asks us, it now comes from a little toddler who is stomping Smurfs.
Yes.
To quote John in a Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus fashion.
That is the official company line now.
All right. Palladium.
Yes.
Ooh.
Now, I want to broaden
now,
this.
Before I start just trashing Palladium, much like I've trashed Shadowrun.
Oh, come on. We can't. Listen, it does not work to say, well, we're not going to talk about Shadowrun anymore, just to shift it to a new game. Because you know what? We're still talking about Shadowrun. Yeah. Only we're calling it Palladium now.
I don't know where you're going with this. But.
I know exactly where I'm going with this.
Fear the Boot is going to have a spinoff show soon called What Chad Hates.
It is going to be longer than the actual show.
It will be. This will be like a 3-hour podcast daily.
I just want to say that I don't hate...
Yes, you do.
Palladium. I've actually played several Palladium games. I had a hell of a lot of fun playing them.
And they're
I don't really...
Nightspawn or Night, which I think I renamed it Nightbane. That was actually a pretty good game.
That was a really good game that we've had to completely we had to change a lot in it to kind of suit our taste.
Right.
But yeah, that was a good game.
And you know, in Palladium's defense, they do have some good material in their books. I like Palladium art. Palladium has some really good art.
It's
in
very
books.
Clean, yeah. Very clean art.
And their books have really good cover art.
Yeah, cover art's all airbrushed.
I had really a couple beefs with Palladium, and one of them I'm just going to hit on briefly because this is a whole massive topic, is, and I'll get this out of the way first. I don't...
10 pounds of rules?
No, that doesn't bother me.
It bothers me.
Well, I'll get to that in a second.
1 pound of rule bothers you.
It's true.
I don't like generic multiverse campaign systems.
Right.
Dan at feartheboot.com.
You know, I'm not a big fan of the Palladium system. I'm not a big fan of the GURPS system. Mm-hmm. And it's not because I think they're just inherently bad.
Well, do you not like the concept of a system that can be ported from game system for campaign exactly. Camps, or do you not like the actual rules, how they handle damage and two hits and that sort of thing?
Think of it this way. The rule system simulates something.
Right.
And the way, and I don't want to get into this too much, because this is a big topic I want to tackle in full bore on another
podcast.
This is
going to be the D20 show.
Well, it's not just D20, but also game system design. Mm-hmm. So this figures into my philosophy on that. Let's do a real simple example. Mm-hmm. If you roll a 1D12, you have a 1 in 12 chance of getting each number on there. Okay, all numbers are equal. So you have just as much chance of failing miserably as you do succeeding. As you do succeeding brilliantly.
Right.
All right. Now, if you take 2d6, a number, a die set that runs about the same span, and you chart out, you write 1 through 6 across the top of the page, 1 through 6 down the left side of the page, and you chart the possibilities, you'll see that only there are 36 combinations. One of them is 2.
My head is spinning.
One of them is 12.
Hey, game math is on the board, too.
It is. That's why I don't get into too much. But there's a huge block in the middle that all works out to 7. So, long story short, what you end up with is a bell curve. So it's very hard
to fail.
What's
the motivation of the king?
So it's very
it's
hard.
Seven.
It's very hard to fail or succeed brilliantly, but it's very likely to roll in the middle.
Yeah.
Now, all right, I apologize for that tangent. It's necessary to work where I'm going. That portrays a feel.
Mm-hmm.
The feel of your game can be very random, where great, wonderful, and things in the middle happen all the time. Or it can be very bell curve where people tend to be average and the extremes are unique.
The examples would be like, say, Shadowrun, for instance, not a Shadowrun bash. Shadowrun is a very vicious game. It's real, you know, it's like you have guns and guns kill people and they kill them very quickly.
A better example I'd give is D&D, because D&D, when you shoot one die, I mean, you can roll the 1 or the 20. You can take the dragon's head off in one swing, or you can drop your own sword, and it's equally likely to do either.
Well, on like Shadowrun, it's like I pump you full of a couple of bullets, provided you're not like have magical enchantments and the body armor and stuff. Say I pump you with a couple of bullets, you're going down. In D&D, if you're a certain level character, I have to hit you with 3,700 arrows before
More, well, okay, and you know, actually, that's not where I was going, but that would work too. That's more of a nature of damage than the way the dice roll. But the point is that every system is meant to reflect something.
Right.
D&D reflects swashbuckling.
Yeah, and it's because you don't want. When you play D&D, you're playing a hero, and you want to take 3,700 arrow hits.
Right,
and
you want to behead the dragon in one lucky swing and things like that. Whereas in a game like Battletech, Shadowrun, more of a realism to it. Mm-hmm. And my problem with Palladium in general, and I think the rules are a little unnecessarily heavy. The rules are too complex in spots, I think. But my larger problem with them is I don't like the multiverse approach. Because, you know, a GURPS system may work beautifully for this particular campaign and setting. Mm-hmm. But you move to another setting, the way it's going to roll out may not capture what you're trying to capture. It's like trying to put a first-person shooter in a game engine that was designed for a driving game.
Yeah.
It's not what it was meant to do, and it's never going to feel quite right. So that is my take on Palladium.
Well, Adam, and this is sort of from the GM perspective. What about from the player perspective? I mean, when you play different games, Adam, do you notice a difference in the rule systems that matters to you? Or can you it's just a rule system, you're rolling dice?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, typically, your GMing style has a lot to do with it. Hmm. You're not rules heavy as a GM, so we're not rules heavy as players, so I don't.
Which, once again, something that probably changed when
his
campaign ends and I run a game.
But I understand what you're saying about the likelihood, like, it's a more average type.
Yeah.
2d6, you're more likely to be average than you are random with
your
the d20.
Your rule system conveys the feel, a certain feel, as well as the campaign setting, as well as the players, as well as the GM, the books, the story, the art. All in a role-playing game product, this all encompasses a feel that is trying to be delivered to you that you play out. And I just don't think that it's a good idea to take one type of rule system that is a part, one part of that feel, and transfer it into another game that is trying to, into everything, or to try and transfer into another game that's trying to convey a totally different kind of feel.
Well, I think they're trying to boil it down to too abstract, so it's flexible enough to put in any situation, and it's too complex of a concept to do that.
And I'm sure the appeal of this to some people is...
There's definite advantages to doing
it. It's easy to learn. Once you've learned it, you just stick it anywhere. But
You can transfer characters from system to campaign setting to campaign setting with ease. And I mean, that's fine for a lot of people.
But it
doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I definitely don't like it. Now, the advice topic for today, and this is continuing right through our the mock Shadowrun game we've been doing, is we're going to talk about what happens when something goes wrong in your plot. And usually this is the result.
Player fault.
Never
a GM fault.
Oh, get out.
Well, if you've got your notes ready and a good campaign and everything written out, there is a 99% probability that a player has done this. That you're going along, the player's supposed to talk to the king, and they refuse to talk to the king.
Right.
Or worse,
they want to cap the king.
Yeah, or they want to shoot the king. And the king was actually the center of the entire campaign.
Yeah.
He was going to give the players their task. So what we want to talk about today is where that can happen, what to do about it, and some things to protect yourself from having it happen in the first place. Mm-hmm. Now, there is not going to be a resource page for today's game, for today's podcast. Mm-hmm. But if you go back and look at the resources section on feartheboot.com and you look at the sample plot we put up for episode 6, we actually are going to be picking up from that, because episode 6, the plot there actually ends with a decision point for the players, where my campaign specifically, there's a councilman who is asking the players to help him investigate an alderman of the same city that he's accusing of being corrupt. And the campaign is written under the assumption that the players will believe him and accept that job. But I left that plot ending where that phone call occurs. And the players, even though I'm thinking they will accept this, they could very well turn on the guy, hang up on him, ignore him. Your job's not good enough. We're not interested. Or, you know what, we think you're the corrupt one. We're coming after you. And so we're going to talk about how to deal with that. I guess you could break down people that screw up your plot really into two categories, which are those that actively derail the plot and those that simply don't follow it.
When you say actively derail the plot, are you talking about disruptive players? Like people throwing popcorn at each other and going wild?
Well, sometimes that's derailing the game, not the plot.
Yeah. Sometimes that there are people who are just, you are leading them down, I mean, subtly as it may be, you're leading them down one specific path. And they just,
they might not know it.
Outside thinking that, you know what, this is too easy.
Yeah.
Something's guiding us there. I don't want to go that way. I want to go this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to use my own, the plot there as an example, if when this councilman calls and says, hey, I want you to do this, if they choose just not to accept the offer, but leave this guy still in play, leave the plot point still out there somewhere, they just don't accept it, they've chosen not to follow it. Now, it's still there. You can come back to it. You can try to lead them back to it. So you have one kind of problem. The other possible is if they turn on the guy, they try to kill him. They say, we think you're corrupt. Now you have the plot completely derailed, because the plot cannot be salvaged as is from that point, because they have just gone backwards up against the current you had in mind. So that's the two kinds of things that we're going to talk about. One of the suggestions that I have for helping you deal with this, and we actually have quite a few we're going to kick around, but let's start with this one. If you have a major branching point in your plot where you know there's a huge likelihood the players could go left or right, and if they go left as opposed to right, it's going to have a massive impact on your game, save it to the end of a game setting.
Yeah.
Create enough filler, create enough stuff along the way, rearrange your plot if you have to, so that what happens is the very last thing that happens in this game is they get asked, will you take this job?
Yeah.
So if they say, no, screw you, we hate you, you have all of next week until your next sitting to figure out what you're going to do with that.
And it lets the players chew on it, too. It's because, you know...
Oh, no, I'd make them give me a decision right there.
Oh, will you?
Well, you can't write for an unknown decision. If you have no idea whether they're going to accept or not, you can't write for that.
That's true.
So I make them give me one right there.
Yeah, but sometimes after a week, you're like, why don't we all listen to this guy? He's a raving idiot. It gives them a little time to rectify any major mistakes that they have made.
Yeah.
Now, should something like that happen where you do lose them at a point you didn't expect, because you can try and plan for this, but there's always the possibility that, as Adam said, they may come back to the game and say, you know what, we change our action. We won't accept the job. And if you're a nice GM, you'll allow that. Maybe you won't.
I'd make them dance a little bit, but I'd let them have it.
Or even if...
Truffle shuffle.
Or even if they do it when you didn't expect it. There's a plot point you thought for sure they would do this, and they didn't. Or a combat just went horribly awry and everybody's in the hospital at the point that they're supposed to be having a face-off against the arc enemy on top of a building or whatever.
Well, that's when you hit just fast forward.
Right, well, but whatever.
3 weeks later.
The point is, something happens that you did not expect to happen.
Yeah.
There's a couple ways that I can come up with to help you save it. One of them, and this is probably the hardest to do, especially if you're an inexperienced GM or don't know your players very well, is change it on the fly.
Mm.
And there's let's talk about a couple. Chad, you're a big improv man. Let's talk about some strategies to do this. Let's say that you've got a plot where I'm supposed to go in and talk to the king, and your general presumption is that the king's going to try and moralize with me, but I'm not going to agree with him, and we're going to continue what we were doing. So let's walk through a couple scenarios.
Yeah.
Okay. The characters come in to talk to the king, and
the king's there, and he's in his regalia, and then he's like, okay, there's this dragon, and I want you to kill him.
And Dude whips out a crossbow and kills him. And actually rolls the dice, rolls the double 20s, instant death, kills him.
He's dead, and they are surrounded by guards. And, you know, well, actually, at that point, you know, I kind of pause it, and I'm like, what are you doing? You know, first I make a check, not a roll check, but just a reality check of saying, dude, is that something your character would do? You know, why did you just whip it out and nail the king? And if they could get, let's pretend that they give me a satisfactory answer.
Well, let's for a minute say they don't. I think that's a valuable point.
Oh, I'll rewind it and take the arrow out of them.
These games are not a fixed reality.
Yeah.
There are some people that are real big sticklers that if you did it, you rolled the dice, it happened.
No, and you're screwing up the story.
Yeah, you know, the game is primarily to have fun and to tell a good story. So if you can pause it and you've just had something occur that's going to destroy the plot, destroy the party, effectively in the campaign, you know, talk it through with them. And if you can... If they say, you know what, that was a mistake, it was dumb, that was a player error, not a character error, let them take it back. I mean,
well, as players...
Keep the story good. Don't make them take it back. I'm a firm believer, don't do that. Don't make them take
it back. Well, you can't force them to do anything.
You can, but you shouldn't. Well, because, as I've said in previous podcasts...
I would make them take it. If his action was outrageously out of character... And he was just doing it because I've been focusing on, we'll say, a couple other characters, and he was bored, and he just wanted to do something. And that was the first opportunity he had. It's not about, oh, well, he's going to destroy my plot, and I don't like that. It's more of a matter of, no, that's just retarded, you know? You wouldn't do that.
And I guess, as always, shade of gray.
Yeah.
I agree with you there. There's somebody does something that's just radically out of character.
If he can give me a good enough reason why he'd nail the king, I don't have a problem.
I guess what I'm saying where I wouldn't go is I've had some GMs where they try to super reinterpret the character. That will based on this in your background and this. And don't do that because, as I've said in previous podcasts, when your player sits down, you as the game master have the universe under your control. They have one dude. Don't take that away from
exactly.
them.
Exactly. Don't role play. Well, I say this, but something I don't follow. Don't role play the characters for them. It's like sometimes, like when I'm opening a scene up, I will say, you know, the doors open to the king's chamber. You walk in and you do your courtly manners and you do this and that. And
right,
that and
but
this.
Don't go too far.
Yeah, I'm not like roboting them.
So pulling that back for that tangent. So the point is, if a player starts to go off the plot, does something stupid, there is some virtue in talking it over with them and letting them take it back. Don't be a crazy stickler and say you did it, you got to keep it. Because in the long run, you may be sacrificing not just continuity and realism, but the enjoyment of your game. So let's say, all right, let's say they're going back to the king thing. Mm-hmm. Let's say somebody pulls it out, doubles 20s, kills the king, and you pause it and they gave you a satisfactory reason. There really is their character's that nuts or whatever.
Sure,
all right.
Whatever.
So your king, who was supposed to be the plot giver for every quest from here.
He's got an arrow in his head and
he's frothing dead on the floor. Your main plot giver is gone. How would you handle this?
The plot just changed. Now they're gonna be running it from the brig. And it's gonna go from a
mission one.
Yeah.
Escape prison.
So it's gonna go from slay the dragon to, you know, escape from Alcatraz.
So is that what you would do with it? That you would just at that point cut the campaign off and rebuild it from that action?
Me?
Yeah. That's what I'm asking.
Yes.
Okay.
Other GMs, I don't think they really should.
I would consider doing that. If you're a good on the fly GM, do it. I would consider doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Another possibility is you have to keep in mind there are many, many things going on in the world your players may not know.
Right.
And just because you didn't know them either doesn't mean they're true. So, for example...
They didn't exist.
No. Let's hear this out. For example, guy pulls out his crossbow, puts one through the king's forehead. At that point, the guards come in, rough up the characters, take away their weapons, run them off to the prison. Shortly thereafter, the prince or the arch wizard of the kingdom or something can come down and say, I've been wanting to get that cat out of the way for years. Thanks for doing that for me.
Now here's the plot to go kill the dragon.
Now go kill the dragon for me.
And then you could also spin it a little bit, too. You could say, you know, the king, he was in league with the dragon and giving him sacrifice. Was he in league with the dragon before they shot the arrow? No.
Right.
Do the players
know that? No.
The players don't know what your plot is. Well, here's the thing. However you want.
Going back on the tangent that you're the DM and that this is your universe, why allow that to happen in the first place? I mean, if this NPC is that major of a character...
Because...
It's a balance issue.
Well, here's the reason. The point of a role-playing game is that you have a character, and as a player, that is all you have, is one character.
Yeah.
And...
Generally speaking,
There is a story... There is a story going on, and you have some power to interact with that story and to change that world. And if the DM comes along and just takes your actions away with really no extremely good reason, it's now kind of gotten to the point that why am I here? That if I have to stick to your story exactly as you wrote it, why don't you just read it to me?
Yeah.
You know, why do I? Because my character is my involvement here. If you won't give me that involvement, just read me the plot. You know, and if it's a great story, hey, wonderful. Yeah. I have a beautiful storytelling session, but it's not a role-playing game.
Right.
Because you're just playing a puppet in this guy's story. You're not playing a character you control anymore.
I see.
Let me ask you this, too. You guys, you know, if you're playing a role-playing game and somebody does that, somebody just thwonks the king, what do you guys want to see? Do you want to see somebody hit stop and rewind the plot like it's a VCR and do it over? Or do you want to see somebody go with it? Or what do you guys want?
Well, in our games, I usually insist that things stop and go back. Because there are a lot of times when one guy will make a decision that affects the entire group on the fly with no reasoning.
It's totally out of character.
Yeah, and it destroys the whole cohesive thing that we had going.
Yeah, the whole RP
flow. We had a flow going, and then because you were bored, you just whipped it out and killed the king with really no reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
So, good game.
All
right, let's go.
Congratulations.
All right, let's go with this from a slightly different perspective. Okay, continuing. We're entering the king's chamber. He's going to tell us to kill the dragon. And at last moment, a character, maybe even for really good RP reason, gets the heebie-jeebies about the whole thing. And the party takes off. They're gone. Yeah. They flee the kingdom.
He convinces them. He's like, guys, I got a bad feeling about this. I think the king's out to get us. In the GM's mind?
It's not true.
King was never out to get anybody. He just wanted this dragon gone. Players think it's true. They bolt.
How do you deal with that one?
Same way I deal with the prison. I let them go.
Let them go and go.
And now that doesn't mean that I just let them go into emptiness, and we have three gaming sessions of them.
Of the void, with Aboleth to zombie.
Them wandering across the countryside and meeting people, and it's like, wow, what a great countryside. Too bad we're not killing a dragon. Now, because I talked before about how I have these encounters in my mind that I want the players to have.
But not sexual encounters.
No, never sexual encounters.
The old role.
Yes, there's never an O roll in my games. So I weave those back into the plot. You know, I don't pull the characters back to the king, but I might rewrite some characters and I might, you know, have them meet a king-like person. They don't know what the king was going to tell them.
See, one of the things I would do with that is have the plot chase them.
That's a good idea, too.
If they take off and leave the kingdom, the king can send runners to go say, hey, would you do this for me? Or I could also sit down and say, wait a minute, maybe I've misjudged their motivations. I thought they would respond to royalty because this guy's a big honor-bound knight, but apparently it's not getting through to them. All right, what does get through to them? Well,
why did they run?
So maybe they ran because they're afraid of kingdoms.
Well, you know, I think you just hit on a major thing there. Getting back to knowing your players, you as a GM... You have to know what motivates your characters.
Right.
You can have a whole plot behind honor and aristocracy and doing the right thing, and every single one of your characters playing a rogue, a ranger, or whatever, and they're only caring about money or revenge or something like that.
And see, and that's what I'd look at is, let's say that you did have an honor-bound knight, because this podcast takes the assumption you did your research, it just went wrong anyway, which it will do, Chaos Theory and all that.
Yeah.
So let's say you did have a big honor-bound knight in there, you thought he'd respond to the king, but he's got some particular RP beef with him, so he takes off. But you know what? That doesn't mean you can't once they get out there to that next town, there's some little girl who's crying because her mother was taken by this dragon, and this dragon's going to kill her. And now this plot, I've not changed the plot. All I've changed is how they get into the plot.
You know, and again, Shade of Grey and all that, you have to be careful because it would get really corny, though, if they make the run for it. They go to this town. They go in the inn, and who's waiting in the inn but the knight? And then they bolt again, and then they spend the night in the farmhouse, and while they're asleep, the knight is standing over them.
Well, yeah, I think the story chasing the players is okay, but not the story hunting the
players. Hunting the players.
Yeah. it's like the predator following the players everywhere they go, it just appears.
You would get...
Croissant in hand.
Yes. Sir Croissant. But you would get... Oh, it'd be Sir Rape. Actually,
yeah, Sir Rape.
Sir Rape
after our last podcast
coming after them.
Something else that I found helps is have some catches in your notes, and let me explain by that. Or if you don't have notes, write this down on a piece of paper, or just think it through. Think it through in your head while
you're trying to say here
nothing at all.
How many of you survive? Roll.
First of all, write some notes about getting them back on plot. And if you look at our sample plot, you will see this, where we have a few points where I say things like, if so far they have not contacted this other player character, here's some things I can do to get him into the plot. Or if at this point they reject this guy's offer, here's some ways I can run with that. So have some little things in there at the points you think the players might go off key, and just have some quick notes to yourself on things you could do about that. The second thing to do is, and this is honestly nothing shy of a time saver or time staller, rather, is write some subplots down. For example, they're going to go and talk to the king about killing the dragon. If they completely refuse to kill the dragon, okay, that's fine. A goblin tribe will waylay them, and they're going to spend a game or two trying to escape from this goblin tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I put that in there? Because that buys me time until the end of the game so I can figure out how I'm going to get them back on the dragon plot.
Mm-hmm.
But have some little subplots like that written down just to...
Well, Dan, what do you do if you try all this stuff, you have all these things, and the players just are totally disinterested with killing the dragon?
At this point, I think what you've got to do is pause the game, and you've got to move this out of the game world into the real world. And you've got to say, one human being to you guys,
right?
We want to have a fun game, you want to play the plot, I want to run the plot, why are you guys not getting involved? And let them, not as characters, but as players, say, it's a boring plot. Or
we've killed 20 dragons, we don't want to kill any more.
Or it's a great dragon, man, but my guy's just not into that because a dragon saved his life when he was a 4-year-old, so he's not going to kill a dragon.
Yeah.
Or whatever the case may be. And then at that point, you know, if you've got to, call it off until next time. Mm-hmm. Say, all right, you know, I didn't know this, I made a mistake. Let me whip out a subplot, or if I don't have a subplot, let me have until next time. Or as a third option, go the other direction. Say, look, I'm not going to make you guys do this, but this is what I have written. Is there a way you could find to kind of spin your character a little bit so this works? That he was saved by a gold dragon, but gold dragons hate black dragons or red dragons, and this is a red dragon. Would he
Everyone
do that?
Hates black dragons.
Yeah, they're always the bad guys.
And so
they're jerks.
You could try and appeal to the players to say, look, is there a way you could make this work with your character so we don't end up going home at 2 p.m.
Right.
And not having a game today because you guys just screwed the plot.
I think that there are other ways to impact it. The players, though, not holding that over them. I know that there are times when we've been playing a game where Chad wants us to get to a certain spot, and he won't come out and tell us to get there, but he wants us to get there. And so he and I will just, outside of the game during the week in between sessions, we will casually start talking about the game. And then he's like, man, I thought you guys were going to do this. And then I'll start thinking, and then I'll bring it to the table. I'm like, you know what, guys? Maybe we could have done this. And it's kind of, it's a very subtle
way
of manipulating
the
group.
Yeah.
Something else that
getting a player on your side as a GM. Thumbs up.
Something else that can help is don't tempt the players. If, for example, you have your whole game take place in a valley, and the valley has tall walls that no one can cross because you don't want them to leave the valley, guess what is going to be their primary objective in every single game is to get out of the damn valley.
We're taking mountaineering skills,
so,
all of us.
Don't tempt them like that. Don't make it, even if there is a specific line you want them to walk, which is probably a bad plot design to begin with, but even if that is the case, don't make that so outwardly evident.
Yeah, and some examples of being like really outwardly evident is you know, you put them in a valley on crossable walls. Or the players look down, there's a map, and, well, what's to the north? Dragons. What's to the south? Impassable desert. What's to the east?
The abyss.
You know, the abyss. What's to the west? We don't know. We don't go there. It's like, that's the same as having impenetrable walls. And right. In fact, it's worse because
I want to go there now.
I know. Nobody goes there. Let's go.
And you know what?
Must be a reason.
And if you tell them you play this a different way, what's to the east? Well, to the east is a rolling meadow that goes down and ends at the ocean, and there's just a couple old men down there fishing.
Fishing!
Yeah.
Josh,
let's kill them.
Get those fish!
Let's kill them and take their fish.
All humor aside, if you've got a pretty mature gaming group, they're not going to be interested. I mean, they may go down and talk to the old men and come back up, but you're not going to see them blowing your plot off to go run up and down this coastline looking for seashells.
Right.
So, at least we hope not. Now, if you're GMing for a bunch of, like, 9-year-old girls, maybe that'll happen.
Ooh, a seashell.
Maybe if you bring props. Now, Dan, let me ask you this, kind of segue into this, too, because we used to do something and totally blew your mind when we did it when we were kids, of our first Star Trek game with maps.
Yes.
Hand-drawn, intricately detailed by Dan.
Right.
Maps.
Yeah,
it would use crayon or marker.
No, it's colored pencils. What we would do, and this was actually based on suggestions that are given in the game books for Fastest Star Trek game, was they suggested that you should have a map drawn up on graph paper with a certain scale to the squares, and the players could, you know, have little counters that they could put on there, not in combat or anything, and just say, this is where I'm standing, this is where I'm going, I'm looking at the door over here, and push their little counters around. And, of course, just like the valley with impenetrable walls, the single most asked question in the game is, what's beyond this page?
Yeah.
That, you know, if I had a map and there was a door to the north and door to the south and I had that drawn up, but there was also a wall to the west, they'd try to burrow through the wall because they wanted to see what was to the west.
Well, they wouldn't put up a wall if there wasn't anything interesting.
And you know what? In real life, I go through doors all the time. I never go over walls in real life.
Right.
So I want to roleplay going out over a wall.
Right. So that's also a bad idea, too. It's just, it goes back to what I said. Don't tempt your players.
So much work, too.
Something else we wanted to... Well, actually, let's take this from a slightly different direction. What about a stuck plot? A plot where it's not a matter of nobody's following it. They're derailing it. But it just kind of seems like...
It's boring.
Or maybe they're not getting involved. They're just not finding the plot. That for some reason, they're just not... They're, you know, you lay this obvious clue. Your mom's been missing. You're interested in that. And here's a guy with a lock of her hair. Well, that's weird. And he goes back to dinner.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Sometimes the characters can be a little obtuse, if you will. And you kind of need to jar it out of them.
Or
that guy with the lock of the hair comes to abduct him.
Right. Or they get abducted. They get interested in a tangent. Things like you wanted them to be trying to find his mom, but instead he determines he can actually manufacture magical items and has now spent the past 3 game sessions manufacturing magical items.
Or there's the bookstore example that we use all the time, too.
Yeah, we actually... this is something we're going to cover in a whole series later on, but we are big fans of making our own games. And based on the stat cards that were on the backs of Transformer boxes, we kind of reverse engineered that into a rule system and made a Transformers game. And they were on a space station that was run by an organic alien race. And there was a store that was selling little information modules, effectively a bookstore.
Yeah.
And they went in there and we literally spent 45 minutes of real time with them.
Oh, just intense.
Yeah.
Not even like role-playing, like developing our characters, but more like, well, what does this guy know?
Yeah.
Well, what kind of books does he have? Well, I want to find out this and that. This had nothing to do with the plot.
Yeah, it was just a freaking, it's just a bookstore.
It's like a Starbucks or a bookstore,
you
know?
Yeah, you walk into a Borders or a Barnes & Noble, and that's all it is.
Ah, the danger of putting culture into your games.
But isn't that kind of the appeal of role-playing game? I mean, you don't want your characters to, like, derail the plot, but at the same time, you want them to have a fully explorable universe that's heavily detailed.
And
you know?
And maybe that's
you can explore a bookstore, but not for 45 minutes.
And, you know, well, and maybe that's, honestly...
It depends on how interesting it is.
Maybe...
That's what my cutoff is. Well, it's like, if they go into the bookstore and it's interesting for like 10, 15 minutes. They're role-playing with the guy. Nothing's happening as far as the overall plot is concerned. That's fine.
Yeah, what if only one person is interested in this and all the other players are falling asleep?
Oh, they'll bully him.
Yeah.
It's out of your hands. The group will bully him.
But I really think that Axe may be onto something.
Yeah, good one, Armoire.
The first impulse of a GM is if my players aren't following my plot, I want to find a way to get them involved in it again. Mm-hmm. And I think we've come up with a couple things here, things like having it follow them, having it literally possibly attack them, that if they won't find the dragon comes to them and starts burning their possessions and trying to kill them.
Yeah, don't screw with my stuff, man.
But, on these tangents, that if they're having fun, the first impulse of a GM is, I got to get them back on my plot, but maybe let them go.
Let them roll with it.
If they're having fun spending hours and hours and hours in the bookstore, let them hang out in the bookstore.
Not to get too heavy on a story, but, one of our Shadowrun games, we were going through, Yeah, I'm getting looks now.
Yeah, we can't get past the Shadowrun.
Well, no, this, go on.
Chad
was not about to bash.
I wasn't about to bash. It was one of Dan's games. And he had this whole plot. I don't even remember what the plot is. I'm sure it involved shadow runs and contacts and bad guys and good guys. And we're shadow runners. We're doing all this stuff. And we're driving down the road and we pass a bank. And we're like, well, hey, it's an anarchist society.
Let's
and
knock
we're
over the bank.
Let's get paid today. And so we came up with the plot stopped. And Dan let us go through this. We tried to knock over the bank and failed miserably at it. And it was really good. It had nothing to do with the plot. And Dan did a good job of just bringing in detail and stuff on the spur of the moment. It was nothing more than we passed a bank driving down the street. And then we made a decision and he ran with it. It was good.
Right. And from there, we got back on the plot and kept going.
Yeah. But that was about a whole gaming session of us trying to knock over this bank.
Talking about Star Trek a little bit earlier, though, kind of reminded me of something.
Fastest Star Trek. Yes. Great game.
It is a good game. Don't put panic buttons in your plot. And what I mean by panic buttons is don't put something in your plot that is so perilously positioned that if anyone was to walk up and nudge it, your plot breaks. And let me give you a good example of this. We were playing Star Trek, and I wrote this really big, intricate game, at least for the age I was then, about how there was going to be this battle computer they were testing on their ship, which, of course, is going to take over the ship, and they've got to try and figure out how to turn it off. Well, very, very first action of the game, 5 minutes into the plot, my brother, who was playing the captain or commodore or whatever of the ship, says, well, I'm not plugging things because I don't trust it, and if I do plug it in, it's only going to be with this safety precaution, power interrupt switches, and all this other crap, where there's no way this computer's ever taking a ship over. My plot's dead.
Yeah.
So... I made something that was far too perilously positioned to protect my plot. And what I probably would have been better off doing, what I would have told myself now, is if I want to have something take over the ship, don't make it something they can so easily interact with.
Right.
Have somebody break onto the ship and do it without their knowledge. Have an alien life form come in and possess the ship, or an alien probe come and latches onto the ship and begins rewiring it and taking it over. Do something that if they screw it up, or they interfere with it, you can pull it back and have it come at the ship another way or come at the crew another way. So don't put anything in your plot that's so fixed that one little kick and your whole game is broken.
It seems like going back to what we did last podcast about session gaming, generalize. Like, getting ultra-specific only leaves you with little flexibility when you start to do things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah,
you don't want to write yourself into a corner.
Yeah. And that gets back to the notes versus improv thing. It's like there's a lot of advantages and disadvantages with improv, and that's one of the advantages and disadvantages with notes. It's like if you have copious amounts of notes that are ultra detailed, well, you're only going to get a couple hours into your game before the players start breaking them in half.
Right, and that's also one of the reasons I suggested at the start of this process is write brief campaign notes.
Yeah, outlines.
But don't
stuff.
Write your plot beyond game one. Because it's going to break. It's going to change. I mean, maybe it won't. If you're really good with your group, you might keep them on. But they're going to change it in some way. So, that's keeping your players on your plot. And we will catch you guys for the next podcast on next Monday.
Thanks, Axe.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.